he'd taken, the men he'd killed, and the women he'd seduced, all at his country's behest. And for what? So that the collection of turban-wearing bearded men who ruled his nation with an iron fist could now cast him away like a dog? No. She's still in Beirut, Darian said, providing the safe house's address. Quds Force operatives are guarding her. An Iranian cargo ship will be docking tomorrow. She'll be put on board and smuggled back to Iran by sea. A much longer process than simply flying her to Tehran, but there will be no incriminating flights between Beirut and Iran when the inevitable hunt to find her begins, Katerina said with a smile. You really have thought of everything, my love. Fortunately, there just so happened to be some Wagner Group employees still in Beirut. Make a call to your Quds Force friends. Tell them you're assigning my mercenaries to augment their security. My comrades will take care of the rest. This time tomorrow, the good scientist will still be on a freighter, but it will be bound for Russia. Sounds like I wasn't the only one who thought of everything, Darian said with a smile. We'll make a great team. Yes, we will, Katerina said, sliding onto his lap. Now, why don't you pull off the road for a bit? It's time to consummate this new arrangement. Darian did exactly as he was told. Chapter 49. Several delightful hours later, Darian slowed the car as they crested a hill. Our friends are already here, Darian said. Katerina's metamorphosis was instantaneous. A moment before, she'd been a carefree girl on a scenic drive through the countryside. Now she was a trained operative. Even Katerina's posture changed. Her soft edges somehow seemed to harden as her bearing became more erect. Darian felt himself undergo a similar change. Now that he was out from beneath the Jew's watchful eyes, he'd returned to carrying his two weapons of choice, a small blade sheathed beneath his left shirt sleeve, and a Glock secured in an inside-the-waistband holster. He touched both as the car coasted down the hill. Early is not good, my love, Katerina said, checking the two-shot Derringer-type pistol she carried at the base of her spine. Be ready. Katerina didn't say what to be ready for. She didn't have to. Though Darian enjoyed her flirty persona, this was the woman he'd fallen for. The case officer with a lethal mind that matched her magnetic personality. A fellow professional who was his equal in both intellect and operational prowess. Like all spies, Darian had been trained to operate alone and had come to crave the solitary nature of his work. No longer. With Katerina at his side, he felt both fulfilled and invincible. Now it was time to put those feelings to the test. What does it mean? Darian said. Don't know, Katerina said. Not an outright ambush. Otherwise, they would have already initiated. They might still want us dead, but they want to talk first. Or maybe they just want to make sure our passenger isn't hurt in the crossfire, Darian said, braking as he nosed the car up against the two trucks. The hill's incline was quite steep, almost a 40% grade. Darian would have to put on the parking brake to ensure the car didn't roll. Strange place for a meet. Unless. See if you can spot another shooter, Darian said as he set the parking brake with a squeal of metal on metal. Look below the military crest of the hill. Katerina was too well trained to turn in her seat. Instead, she angled the passenger side mirror. Got him, Katerina said. My sight, in a hide sight just beneath the lip of the hill. Great spot. He's got line of sight on the entire road as well as us, Darian said, finishing her thought. If this is an ambush, it will happen after they confirm we have Ryan. Stay in the car and keep an eye on the sniper. If you see him shift his focus from the road to me, beep the horn. I'll take care of the rest. You are very brave, my darling, Katerina said, unhooking her seatbelt, but also very foolish. Your concern for my safety is touching, but misplaced. I am a veteran of the Slujba Veneshni Razvedki. I'm quite competent at my job. Besides, we all know how these Mudok view women. Darian reached across the car to grab Katerina's hand, but found himself grasping air instead. In one fluid motion, Katerina popped open the door and slid from the car. With a curse, Darian released his own seatbelt and followed, still trying to come to terms with the muddle the Russian made of his thoughts. For the first time in his life, he wasn't the one with the golden tongue, the person who charmed others into betraying their country. As he caught Katerina's eye, the half-formed thoughts he'd tried to put into words solidified. His reticence to allow her to leave the relative safety offered by the car wasn't because he doubted her abilities. Far from it. It was because he wasn't at all certain that he could imagine a life without her. For an instant, her blue eyes softened, as if reading the words stuck in his chest. Then the sentiment vanished, and only the Moscow-trained operative remained. Darian almost pitied the pair of men walking toward them. They probably thought they had Darian at a disadvantage. For their sake, Darian hoped they didn't give Katerina a reason to demonstrate otherwise. "Assalamu alaikum," Darian said, greeting the two men. "Wa alaikum salam," the nearer man replied, his response sounding somewhat grudging to Darian's ears. Then again, neither man looked like the epitome of joy. Unlike most of the inhabitants of this part of the world, the men weren't dressed in the faux Western style of city occupants. Instead of jeans, shirts, and tennis shoes, the men wore clothes from another era. Brown abba robes complemented by white turbans. The AK-47s slung across their chests were the pair's only concession to modernity, a suspicion reinforced by the way they both studiously ignored Katerina. The men had the bearded, weather-beaten faces of those who lived exposed to harsh desert conditions. Their frames were identically slender, as if any excess fat had long ago been scoured away by the unrelenting sun and wind. The man closer to Darian had facial hair that seemed to begin at the base of his throat and extend all the way up to the single eyebrow that bridged the gap between two distrustful eyes. In contrast, his partner had more peach fuzz than whiskers, and the feeble facial hair did little to soften his pinched features. Taken together, the two resembled a bear standing next to a weasel. Their countenance was just as friendly. Then again, Darian supposed that a sunny personality wasn't a prerequisite for membership in an apocalyptic cult. "Who is the woman?" the bear said. "My whore," Darian said. "Forgive her dress. She's Russian and doesn't speak Arabic." As one, the men turned their backs on Katerina, who mumbled something in Russian before shuffling to a point behind the men. It took everything within Darian not to smile. That easily. The former SVR operative negated their numerical advantage while giving herself a clear view of the shooter on top of the hill. Good didn't even begin to describe his partner. "You were supposed to come alone," Bear said. Darian shrugged. "I don't often do what I'm told. Take what I've brought or don't. I don't care. I'm sure your imam will be very understanding if you return without it." Bear glanced at Weasel, who gave a short nod. "Fine," Bear said, "but you can explain her presence yourself." "What?" Darian said. "You're supposed to deliver the cargo," Bear said. "That was not the arrangement," Darian said. He delivered his line with a bored tone, but his heart rattled against his ribs like a snare drum. If a double cross was to occur, it would happen now. Katerina took a half step to her right as she gave another delightful stretch. "It is now," Bear said. "Your boss, the general, told the imam that you would deliver the cargo in person. The general said to tell you Saat, but feel free to call and ask for clarification. I'm sure he will be very understanding." Saat, or clock, was the recognition code word for this operation. The only way these two goons would know it was if Ahmadi really had given Darian new orders. He paused, considering his options while keeping his face expressionless. He'd intended to simply vanish with Katerina after providing Ryan to the cultists. But if he balked now, the two men would be on the phone with Ahmadi the moment Darian climbed back into the car. Knowing the crafty old fox, Ahmadi had probably arranged some sort of check-in with the men, meaning that even if Darian killed them, the general would still know something was amiss, and he wasn't ready for the Quds Force operative to know that he'd been betrayed. Not just yet. Which meant that his only choice was to keep up this facade for a little longer. Fine, Darian said. Let's go. Chapter 50. Jack awoke with the kind of hangover that made him want to swear off alcohol even before he'd forced his crusty eyelids open. Though he'd thrown back a couple from time to time, he'd never let things get this far out of control. Hell, he couldn't even remember what he'd been celebrating, let alone where he was now. Not to mention that his pounding head was only part of the problem. His inner ear was convinced that the world was bucking and sliding, and he had yet to open his eyes. This was going to be one of those times when it was fortunate to have a doctor in the family, even if she was an ophthalmologist. A particularly vicious jolt sent Jack smashing against a decidedly unforgiving section of steel. He instinctively tried to shield his face, but couldn't. His arms were handcuffed behind him. Banging his head against something hard wasn't the preferred method to clear away the grogginess, but it seemed to work. The nauseating smell of gasoline, ever-present darkness, and tight confines suggested that Jack was stuffed in the trunk of a car. As his foggy brain came back online, stimuli crashed over him. The noxious odor of car exhaust competed with damp, mildewing carpet. A bundle of rags by his head smelled of motor oil, while the sour scent of body odor and fear permeated everything. Definitely a trunk. Stretching as far as he could, Jack tried to flex in order to get his blood circulating. He was partially successful. His legs and back announced their displeasure with a series of muscle cramps, while his arms were still masses of unresponsive jelly. Turning his hips, Jack shifted from his back to his side, gritting his teeth against the pins and needles sensation. Whatever the waitress had injected him with had been a doozy. Thousands of invisible wasps venting their frustration on his arms and hands helped drive away the remaining mental fogginess. But much like the returning blood flow to his contorted limbs was a mixed bag, full mental functionality came with a price. Though the semi-darkness prevented Jack from getting an accurate depiction of his surroundings, he could sense the trunk's metal confines enclosing him like a coffin. A debilitating claustrophobia struck without warning, forcing Jack to take shuddering breaths through his mouth to confront the phobia. Closing his eyes, he concentrated on his other senses, fighting against the feeling that the metal walls were pressing in around him. His heart rate and respiration were both accelerating. In an effort to combat the panic, Jack focused on his breathing, sucking fetid air in through his mouth, holding it for a two count, and then exhaling it out through his nose in a long, steady breath. While the breathing exercises helped control his physical stress, they were less effective against his mental foes. The sudden feelings of isolation and helplessness were almost overpowering. He'd been snatched in a city infamous for devouring the unwary and unlucky. The campus's required reading list featured Beirut Rules, co-written by former DSS agent Fred Burton. The work of nonfiction was a primer on Middle East terrorism, and it covered the kidnapping, torture, and the eventual murder of the Beirut CIA station chief, William Buckley, in excruciating detail. Unlike many victims whose kidnapping represented their first encounter with violence, Bill Buckley was a former Green Beret who'd served in Vietnam. He'd understood the primeval nature of combat, but even he hadn't stood a chance against his Hezbollah captors. After being traded from one jihadi group to another, Bill's discarded body was finally discovered more than a year after his initial capture. While Jack knew it was dangerous to draw conclusions based on events separated by 35 years, he also knew that the recovery rate for kidnapping victims in this part of the world was minuscule. Now was the time to be bold, to take life or death chances, even if the odds of success seemed remote, because this was when the kidnappers were also most vulnerable. Once his captors reached wherever they were taking him, the odds would be stacked in their favor. but now both parties were in a kind of no man's land. Jack was cut off from his allies, as were his kidnappers. This might be his only chance to escape, and Jack intended to take it. As if the car's occupants could read his mind, Jack heard the engine's constant thrum lose its roar as the vehicle began to slow. This was not ideal. Jack had hoped for some time before confronting his captors. Time to plan, or at the very least, discover what he might put to use in the cramped compartment. One of Ding's famous adages came to mind. The enemy always has a vote. Fumbling with his still smarting fingers, Jack felt along the damp carpet, searching for something, anything that might aid him. He wanted a lug wrench, or at least a stray screwdriver, but his fingers touched only rags and threadbare fabric. While his situation was far from ideal, Jack still possessed one very potent weapon. Hope. Jack had access to something that Bill Buckley had not. Just before his capture, he'd activated Gavin's Eye of Sauron. As he understood it, the app turned his cell phone into an electronic black hole, a clandestine collection device that vacuumed up and logged all the surrounding digital traffic across the width and breadth of the electronic spectrum before forwarding the take to Gavin. If the eye worked as planned, the hacker would be able to sic the campus's machine learning algorithms on the data, sorting IPs, MAC addresses, and globally unique identifiers. Once its targets were acquired, the eye launched cyber attacks designed to penetrate and compromise each device's operating system. If a bad guy had a phone in the eye's vicinity, Jack would own it. While Jack had been separated from his phone soon after he'd been captured, he was hopeful that the hacker's electronic soldiers had cataloged the bad guy's devices and compromised them. Best case scenario, his captor's cells were now live mics. Worst case, Gavin was now tracking their location in real time. At least Jack hoped that was the worst case scenario. But worst case or not, Jack was operating on the assumption that his comrades in arms knew he was in trouble and were even now bringing the campus's considerable resources to bear on rescuing him. But technological wizardry aside, his fellow operatives weren't miracle workers. They'd need time to execute a rescue, and Jack intended to give it to them. At least that was the plan, anyway. The vehicle stopped, and the slamming of car doors echoed through the trunk. Jack flexed his fingers and wiggled his toes, trying to bring his deadened extremities to life, but searing pins and needles were his only reward. This was unfortunate, but not the end of the world. Once he got vertical, gravity would help to restore his circulation. Until then, he needed to keep his wits about him and watch for a chance to act. The trunk popped open and rough hands dragged him from the darkness. Blinding sunlight played havoc with Jack's already throbbing head, stabbing through his eyeballs with an ice pick's compassion. Somehow, the outside air smelled worse than the trunk. A stench Jack associated with day-old roadkill clogged his nose, and his stomach threatened to empty. Struggling not to gag, Jack blinked past the tears streaming down his face, desperate for a look at his new surroundings. For a long moment, the blurry world refused to resolve into something recognizable. Then it did. At first, Jack saw what he expected, the waitress and her VC boyfriend. The woman smiled at him in a way that made his heart rate accelerate. Then Jack saw a trio of men standing next to the operatives and felt his stomach drop. He was not in Kansas anymore, or even Beirut. Dressed in the tobe robes and sirwal trousers of desert Bedouins and armed with AK-47s, the men introduced themselves via a series of blows to Jack's unprotected head and torso. One guard held Jack upright while the other two went to work on him with their fists and their rifles' wooden stocks. When it ended, Jack found himself supported by two of the men, his ability to stand on his own beaten out of him. Determined fingers grabbed his hair and wrenched his lolling head upward. "That was for the men that you killed at the apartment," the waitress said, her face inches from his. "My men. Goodbye, Jack Ryan." She released his hair, and Jack fought to keep his head upright, watching as the waitress and her master spy boyfriend walked off in the company of two more of the robed jihadis. For the first time since he'd been dragged from the car, Jack took in his surroundings. To his left was some sort of compound resembling a medieval fortress, complete with 15-foot earthen berms. But it was what was in front of him that Jack found most troubling. Death. Stephen King-style death. Rows upon rows of leafless trees stretched out before him. But they weren't trees. They were crosses. Crosses adorned with the decomposing remains of countless corpses. The searing image and horrific smell of rotting, bloated meat overpowered Jack. Ducking his head, he spewed a burning stream of bile onto the parched earth. This earned him a strike to the back of his head that turned his legs to rubber. But his inability to walk didn't stop the guards from dragging him toward the killing field. As they drew closer, Jack was forced to change his earlier assessment. Most of the crosses were occupied, but not all. A length of freshly cut wood lay on the ground next to a tripod-mounted camera. And Jack was headed straight for it. Chapter 51. Al-Tanf Outpost, Syria. Reaper 7, this is Reaper 14, over.
Gopher 7,
Kerry said, not so much whispering his reply as sending it telepathically. Originally, Kerry had thought Jad's concern about their hide site's proximity to the compound was unfounded. The plateau on which the men were located was only 300 meters from the structure's imposing walls, but it offered an excellent view of the compound's dormitory and newly constructed truck park. Tarps still stretched overhead, obscuring the MLRS from drones or satellites, but Kerry had a perfect vantage point. In fact, he'd already tried out the Ground Laser Target Designator, or GLTD, and was satisfied with the return signal. The hide site was much closer to the fortress's walls than Kerry would prefer, but the location was, in a word, perfect. Unfortunately, the dozen or so cult members who'd decided to use the plateau for a pickup game of soccer seemed to be of the same opinion. So far, the soccer players had been too engrossed in the game to notice two green berets squatting in a hastily dug chest-deep hole covered with camouflage netting less than 50 meters away. But Kerry didn't know how much longer his good fortune would last. Though neither Kerry nor Jad had so much as batted an eyelash in the last 30 minutes, their hide site was situated just beyond the nearest goal. As luck would have it, the keeper on their side of the field wasn't very good. Sooner or later, the ball was going to roll just a little too far. When it did, hell would roll with it. Reaper 7, Reaper 14. A vehicle just rolled up to Pet Cemetery. They popped the trunk and unloaded a new customer. He's in pretty bad shape. They're dragging him toward an empty cross now.
14, 7, roger all. The F-15s will be on station in 1-5 mics. Until then, we can't afford to be compromised. Over.
Roger that, 7. Understood. It's just that this guy isn't one of the usual suspects. He looks American. Over. Kerry felt his blood pressure spike. Like most of his teammates, he'd been drawn to special operations to satisfy a very primal need. He wanted to take the fight directly to the bad guys in a way that conventional forces could not. De oppresso liber, the motto of Army Special Forces, means to free the oppressed, and Kerry had fulfilled this creed in a variety of different ways since donning the Green Beret years ago. Even so, there was one mission that was considered sacrosanct, hostage rescue. Specifically, the rescue of American hostages kidnapped by terrorists or their ilk. This mission set was one of the reasons Delta Force was formed. Nearly every special operator longed for the day when he might be the one kicking in a door and saving an American hostage. Even so, the mission brief for Triple Nickel's current operation had been pretty unambiguous. Get into position, clear the cruise missiles of collateral damage, and guide in the F-15's small-diameter bombs. If the payloads on the Iranian missiles really did carry chemical or biological agents, tens of thousands of lives were at stake. And yet...
14, 7, did you get a shot of the victim's face?
7, affirmative.
Roger that, 14,
Kerry said. Break.
Reaper 6, this is 7.
Go for Reaper 6, Alex said.
Roger 6, we've got eyes on a potential American hostage, and from the looks of things, our boys are about to nail him to a cross. Reaper 14's got imagery. Can you pass it up the chain of command? He could be a kidnapping victim, and we've still got time to intervene.
Reaper 6 copies all. Send the pic, and I'll see what I can do. But unless we hear otherwise, our mission priorities do not change for the next 15 mics. Over.
Reaper 7 acknowledges. Continuing mission. Kerry was frustrated, but he knew his team leader was right. He imagined that Alex didn't like giving the order to stand down any more than Kerry liked hearing it. But they were both soldiers, and soldiers followed orders. A vibration at his chest announced an incoming data file from Reaper 14. Kerry unfolded an Android device about the size of a cell phone from its holder on his plate carrier. Mounted in the center of his chest and wired into his radios, the device provided Kerry with both situational awareness in the form of a moving map display and real-time access to the suite of sensors his team employed. Kerry swore as he looked at the picture. American or not, the man was on his last legs. Kerry couldn't help but think that this simple observation mission was about to become much more complex. No Green Beret was naive enough to think that an operation would go exactly as briefed. Change was the one constant, but in this case, Kerry welcomed the chance to deviate from the operation's order. He just hoped that the change of mission came down before the poor bastard got himself nailed to a cross.
Chapter 52. Jack had heard people talk about the moment your life flashed before your eyes, but he'd never experienced it. Perhaps because when his life was truly in danger, he'd been too busy trying to stay alive to contemplate his existence. Or maybe it was because he'd never been in a situation he hadn't thought he'd somehow survive. Until now. As the three men hustled Jack toward the waiting cross, he knew that this time there was no escape. He had no weapons and no hope of the cavalry riding to the rescue. He was completely and utterly alone, with the exception of his captors. The men dragging him across the densely packed soil weren't much on casual conversation, but the jostling was beginning to force blood into Jack's extremities. The pins and needles sensations had largely subsided, and feeling had returned to his hands and feet. He could probably walk if need be, but he didn't try. Better that his executioners thought he was still incapacitated. Unfortunately, they weren't taking any chances. The burly one to his left fired a punch into Jack's ribs that sent him to his knees. Then the base of his skull exploded. The rabbit punch had been expertly delivered and didn't so much knock the fight out of Jack as destroy his ability to think about anything but the blinding pain. By the time his thoughts cleared, Jack was on his back against a coarse length of wood. One man was pinning his wrist to the crossbeam, while the other was straddling his hips. Jack tried to buck free and received two punches in the jaw for his trouble. And then a third man stepped into view. He'd been fiddling with the camera while his friends were working Jack over, but now seemed ready to join the party. Jack squinted, trying to make out what the man was holding in his hand. A hammer. A motherfucking hammer. The man with the hammer squatted next to Jack's left arm, and then Jack felt a cold pinprick of steel against his biceps. The nail. Chapter 53.
Reaper 7, this is Reaper 6.
Kerry jerked as if he'd been slapped. Alex was calling on the command frequency, which meant that only he and Kerry were privy to what was being said. Things were about to get interesting.
Go for 7, Kerry said.
Roger 7, Alex said. I've got some hinky shit here. That picture is definitely of an American. In fact, he's an agency case officer who was kidnapped in Beirut.
No shit,
Kerry said, his surprise causing him to break radio protocol. I shit you not, Reaper 7. We are cleared hot to rescue him. As long as we also complete our assigned mission. Over.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot,
Kerry said, feeling his neck beginning to flush.
What are we supposed to do with that?
I know, Alex said. It's bullshit.
Higher headquarters is trying to cover their ass and leaving us hanging out to dry in the process. What do we do?
Negative, Reaper 7. It's what I'm going to do. As the on-scene commander, I'm going to exercise a bit of tactical discretion. You're the man on the ground, and I trust your judgment. If you think we can save him, do it. If not, guide those bombs in, and we'll do what we can for the American after those launchers are smoking holes. No matter what happens, I'll take the heat.
In that moment, Carrie would have walked through fire for Captain Alex Brown. The ODA team leader was behaving exactly as an officer was supposed to, giving his men the latitude to do what they did best while running interference. While Kerry loved his captain, he still wasn't all that crazy about the hand that he'd just been dealt. 500 meters to his right, a trio of cultists had the American on his back. 300 meters inside the compound, a black tarp snapped and popped in the desert wind, showing glimpses of the heavy-duty trucks with the boxy MLRS in their cargo beds. Less than 50 meters away, the soccer game continued unabated, the players drifting ever closer to his hide site. Oh, and he couldn't forget the sortie of F-15s streaking toward him as they prepared to loose their cargo of small-diameter bombs in just under 10 minutes. Kerry closed his eyes, thinking through the various scenarios, trying to find a way to thread the needle. But he already knew that there was no magic solution. He either let the American die, or didn't. The choice was binary. Snapping open his eyes, Kerry keyed the radio transmit button and began to speak. "All Reaper elements, this is Reaper 7. Stand by for change of mission." Chapter 54. Clearing his throat, Jack spat at the hammer man's looming face. His aim couldn't have been better. A glob of blood-encrusted saliva blossomed on the man's cheek. The hammer that had been hanging in the air retreated as the man wiped the spit from his face with his shoulder. Success. Or at least success in the only way that Jack could currently measure it. Every second he wasn't nailed to a length of lumber was an additional second for someone or something to change the balance of the equation. In the grand scheme of rescues, the tiny ember of hope wasn't much, but Jack would take what he could get. But his victory didn't last. The hammer man cuffed Jack in the face with his closed left fist, the fist with the nail. Jack's teeth snapped together as blood filled his mouth. Fire burned the length of his cheek where the nail had furrowed his skin. But his cheek was the least of Jack's concerns. The hammer man had shifted, now kneeling on Jack's forearm. The hammer blurred upward, and Jack knew there was no distracting his would-be executioner from his task. So he didn't try. Instead, Jack timed the hammer's swing and bridged, pushing off the wood while throwing his hips to the left in the moment before impact. Then metal tore through flesh. Chapter 55. Kerry paused mid-transmission as the event he'd been dreading finally happened. The opposing team's scrappy forward gave the dusty ball a full-legged boot that went sailing past the subpar keeper. The black-and-white ball kicked up a dust tail as it blazed an unwavering path toward the commando's hide site like it was a guided missile. "Whatever you're going to do, do it fast," Jad whispered, his cheek welded to his rifle's stock. The ball skipped along, the keeper pumping his legs in pursuit. 500 meters and a world away, one of the thugs pinning the American to a wooden cross raised his hammer for a second swing, while the CAS mission clock on Kerry's android read 9 minutes and 37 seconds. Sunlight glittered across the hammer as it began its downward swing. The ball bounced into the mesh camouflage netting concealing Kerry's hide site and rebounded. The pursuing cultist skidded to a halt. "Boss," Jad said, moving his rifle's safety selector switch to fire. A black tarp flapped in the breeze, sheltering a forest of launchers. Who lives? Who dies?
"Kerry!"
"Take the shot," Kerry said. Chapter 56. The pain was exquisite. The tempered steel slid into his arm, parting skin and muscle like a knife sliding through butter.
Jack screamed as the rational portion of his mind registered a deep thunk, followed by the hammer man's grunt of surprise. It was only as the man toppled forward that Jack noticed he was missing the back of his head. The hammer clattered to the ground next to Jack's arm, the arm that was nailed to a wooden cross. Fuck. Time stood still as the remaining executioners looked from their fallen comrade to Jack, as if he were somehow responsible. Then a second thunk, and the man straddling Jack's hips tumbled to one side, blood spurting from his shoulder. The man pinning Jack's arm crouched, lowering his silhouette. Jack finally recognized the significance of the thunks. Someone with a suppressed, high-powered rifle was trying to even the odds. Jack was still half-nailed to a cross, with a madman pinning his arm and a wounded fighter thrashing in the dirt beside him. But his feet were free. Groaning against the pain, Jack crossed his legs over the remaining fighter's neck, cinching them tight. The man grunted, threading an arm between Jack's legs in an attempt to steady himself. Jack struck like a mongoose, seizing the arm one-handed and yanking it toward his chest, pulling the fighter into a modified triangle choke. The man's eyes bulged as Jack tightened his legs, applying more pressure to the blood choke. For a moment, Jack had him. Then the man rocked to his left, dragging Jack's torso with him as he pitted their combined weight against the nail, pinning Jack's flesh to the wood. The pain was electric, an all-consuming agony he could taste. Jack screamed as he fought to hold the choke, bearing down with his thighs and hamstrings, desperately trying to ease the strain on his arm by engaging his core. The man's eyes glassed over. He slumped farther to his left, dragging Jack with him. The nail's head tore into flesh. It was too much. Caught between the nail and the man's dead weight, Jack loosened the choke in an attempt to ease the strain on his arm. The pain radiating down his shoulder subsided, but the man's eyes fluttered as blood rushed back to his oxygen-starved brain. Then the look of animal fear on the fighter's face was replaced by something else. Cunning. With a snarl, the man gathered his legs and pushed off the ground, rocking from side to side. Each oscillation jarred Jack's arm against the nail, the agony stealing the air from his lungs. Jack tried to breathe through the pain, tried not to focus on the feel of his flesh ripping or the torrent of blood soaking his shirt. But he couldn't. The larger man had leverage and momentum on his side. He was growing stronger by the second, while Jack was getting weaker. It was time for the unthinkable. Gathering his courage, Jack coiled his legs to his chest, dragging the fighter closer. The man responded by exploding upward and to Jack's right, attempting to escape the choke once and for all. But rather than constrain the man's motion, Jack amplified it. He kicked both legs straight up in a modified kip, using the man's momentum to wrench himself upward. Flesh pulled away from metal with a hideous ripping sound, and Jack nearly fainted. He'd intentionally shifted his body just before the nail had gone in, to take the wound on the fleshy part of his arm near his triceps instead of through the bone. He'd succeeded. Sort of. The arm ripped free in a gush of blood. The sudden lack of resistance sent the fighter stumbling to his knees, Jack's legs still draped around his neck like a feather boa. A jiu-jitsu purist would have cinched down the triangle again, but Jack wasn't a martial artist. He was a brawler. So while his attacker wasted precious seconds clearing Jack's legs from his neck, Jack dedicated the time to a more pressing matter: finding the hammer. Grabbing the mallet with his right hand, Jack swung the tool in a tight arc, catching the fighter in the knee. Bone crunched against metal, and the man screamed, forgetting about Jack's legs as he pitched to the ground. Jack rode the fighter into the dirt, raining down blows as he worked his way from knee to thigh to arm, and then finally to the ultimate prize, the head. Two strikes, and it was done. Jack clambered unsteadily to his feet, blood snaking down his arm in fat, wavering drops. For the moment, equal parts adrenaline and shock were shielding him from the worst of the pain. But those fickle allies would change allegiances soon enough. He needed to staunch the blood flow. Now. Jack followed the crimson tracks up his arm and swallowed. His shirt was matted with blood, partially obscuring the wound, but Jack could still see the jagged tear running the length of his triceps. Gritting his teeth, Jack turned what was left of his shirt into a makeshift pressure bandage, looping the fabric around his wounded arm before tying off the knot one-handed. As he put the finishing touches on the ad hoc compress, Jack had the disconcerting feeling that he was forgetting something. Like a buzzing static, his survival instincts were screaming at him, but Jack couldn't understand why. The lightheadedness made it hard to concentrate, and he turned in a wobbly circle. Then he understood. The third attacker. Jack had forgotten the unseen sniper's second victim, the fighter who'd been wounded in the shoulder. Now the forgotten man was on his feet, facing Jack. One arm dangled uselessly at his side, but the other held an AK-47 by its pistol grip. The gunman was about 10 feet away, much too far for Jack to close the distance with a rush, even if he had the energy. More than close enough for the man to fire the rifle one-handed. The muzzle bobbled as the fighter struggled against shock and blood loss, but at this distance, he could fire blindfolded and still put a round through Jack's breastbone. Jack roared, hurling the hammer while waiting for the inevitable punch in his chest. It never came. Instead, the man's head disintegrated in an explosion of brain matter and gore as Jack's hammer flew harmlessly by. Jack stared dumbfounded as the fighter crumpled. A moment later, his overloaded brain registered the dull thunk that had accompanied the destruction, along with a more distinct crack of a rifle bullet breaking the sound barrier. Turning in the direction of the sound, Jack raised a hand in thanks. Then he grabbed the dead man's AK-47 and faced the compound's looming walls. He was alive, but this was far from over. One way or another, he was going to find Becca and Tommy. He didn't know where they'd been taken, but he knew someone who did. And those people were inside the compound. Wedging the AK-47 between his knees, Jack charged the bolt to the rear one-handed, ensuring a round was chambered, and then he put the weapon on safe. As plans went, this wasn't his finest. But like his SEAL friends said, the only easy day was yesterday. Except yesterday hadn't been much of a cakewalk either. Maybe he'd have better luck tomorrow. If he lived that long. Chapter 57. You got our precious cargo? Kerry said, fitting his rifle to his shoulder.
Affirmative, Jad said. He's a scrapper. I nailed two of the bad guys and he finished off the third with a hammer.
Oh, shit. What is that crazy fucker doing? Kerry panned his optic across Pet Cemetery just in time to see the man getting unsteadily to his feet. Turn around, Kerry said, attempting to will the American back toward the desert and safety in the form of the remaining members of the A-team. Turn around and get the hell out of there.
But the American did not get the hell out of there. Instead, he shook his head twice like a dog shedding water from his coat. Then he squared his shoulders and charged into the compound, one arm dangling limply at the shoulder. Without waiting for his spotter-turned shooter to respond, Kerry ignored the bare-chested man just 10 meters away, who was still staring at the hide site in disbelief in favor of the men 75 meters distant, men running toward the pile of neatly stacked AK-47s they'd abandoned next to their shirts. Jad's rifle had been suppressed, but it was not silent, and at least one of the soccer players recognized the sound for what it was. Kerry took a breath, centered the red dot hovering in the center of his holographic sight on the man nearest the rifles, and squeezed the trigger. The rifle kicked. The man fell to the ground. And all hell broke loose. Chapter 58.
Sit down, please, the greasy-haired man said, indicating a pair of camp chairs resting against the wall. The imam will be with you shortly. Darian shot a glance at Katerina and then settled into the closest seat, as she took one on the far side of the room. For a fortress so meticulously constructed, the furnishings were rather threadbare. The revetments fortifying the compound consisted of reinforced concrete fronted by tons of bulldozed rocks and soil. The access points were manned by competent-looking shooters and crews served weapons, while pricey surveillance cameras were strategically positioned to observe high-speed avenues of approach. Just inside the compound, a motor pool showcased a fleet of well-maintained vehicles, many of them outfitted with heavy machine guns, recoilless rifles, or grenade launchers. Darian had even noticed a collection of American Humvees. When it came to weapons and equipment, the cult had spared no expense. The same couldn't be said for sitting chairs and couches. Darian shifted his weight, trying to get comfortable. Katerina also squirmed, but Darian imagined this had more to do with positioning her hidden pistol for a quick draw than easing the burden on her posterior. Not that he blamed her. While Darian knew that the madmen living in the compound played an outsized role in the general's equally mad plan to forever alter the balance of power in the Middle East, he'd never imagined meeting Ahmadi's pawns face to face. Though he'd grown up in Iran under a Shia-inspired theocracy, Darian, like many Iranians his age, wasn't particularly religious. What he'd done as an intelligence operative had been for the betterment of his country, not the power-mad men who ruled her. But this compound seemed like a distillation of what the Ayatollah and his ilk wanted for Iran if left to their own devices. A select few who heard directly from Allah giving instructions to the masses, who had no choice but to do their bidding. From Darian's perspective, these fools would certainly accomplish at least one of their goals. This would be the site of a grand battle. Of that, Darian was certain. He was just as certain that he had no intention of being here when it happened.
"Ah, Darian, thank you for joining us. I hope your journey was pleasant."
The magnetism radiating from the man who strode into the room was palpable. Though he went to great pains to wear the traditional robes and black turban in order to appear like the reincarnated imam he was pretending to be, there was nothing poor or downtrodden in the quality of his wardrobe. Clearly the money saved by skimping on simple furnishings had been reinvested in Mahdi Husseini's person. Then again, Darian supposed that an imam reborn after a 1,200-year absence needed to look the part. As had been the case with the other male cultists he'd encountered thus far, Husseini swept by Katerina without acknowledging her presence in the slightest. Within the fortress's four walls, women didn't even warrant inclusion into the category of seen but not heard. That distinction was reserved for children. Here, outside of domestic duties and procreation, women were non-entities. Katerina wasn't acknowledged because to these Neanderthals, she didn't exist.
"Pleasant enough," Darian said as he stood and extended his hand, "but still unexpected."
"Oh?" Husseini said. "How so?"
"I was originally supposed to deliver the American to your men," Darian said, "not bring him here myself. I'm curious why the plan changed."
Darian was not just curious. He was desperate to understand what the cult leader was thinking. Or perhaps more important, what new machinations the cult leader's puppet master, General Ahmadi, was scheming. If his goal was just Darian's death, the Quds Force commander could have ordered Husseini's minions to take care of business in the middle of the desert, far from prying eyes. No, something else was at play here, something much more insidious. At Darian's request, Katerina had put the Beirut safe house where the American scientist and her child were being held under surveillance, but she hadn't yet sent her mercenaries to recover them. Putting himself in the old fox's place, Darian had to believe that Ahmadi had some sort of check-in procedure in place with his Quds Force henchmen. The Iranian vessel wasn't due to dock for several more hours, which meant that Darian had to play this game very, very shrewdly. Act too soon, and Ahmadi would know that he'd been betrayed. Knowing the Iranian, he would probably exact his vengeance on the most valuable commodity Darian had to offer his new employer, the American scientist. But if he waited too long, Darian risked forfeiting something even more consequential: his life.
That plan hasn't so much changed, Husseini said, scratching the luxurious black beard that covered his chin, as become better.
How so? Darian said. From her forgotten corner on the other side of the room, Katerina uncrossed her legs, placing both feet flat on the floor. For a moment, her pale blue eyes found Darian's. Then she stared off into space, as if she hadn't a clue what was transpiring.
Darian kept his expression suitably nonchalant as his heart rate accelerated. Katerina didn't get jumpy. If she too felt the tension-saturated air, something wasn't right.
Are you a believer? Husseini said,
his brown eyes peering into Darian's as if trying to discern his thoughts.
You'll have to be more specific, Darian said.
I believe in a great many things.
Darian kept his tone light, judging distances. The distance from his hand to the pistol secreted in his belt. The distance from the two goons flanking Husseini and the door behind him. And most important, the distance to the car. On the whole, the distances did not favor him. That needed to change.
In me, Husseini said, do you believe that I am one of the 12 imams reborn?
The cult leader asked the question with the kind of offhand manner one might use to inquire about the weather. Darian wasn't fooled. This was exactly the type of nonsense that had made him caution his MOIS superiors about getting involved with Ahmadi's mad plot to begin with. Unfortunately, here again the general had prevailed. With a little encouragement, Ahmadi believed that he could persuade the cult to become a thorn in the American's side. A powder keg of fanatics just waiting for a match. Then the Quds Force commander had envisioned a way to further up the stakes while remaking the entire Middle East in the process. After all, if the cultists were dead set on triggering Armageddon, why not help them achieve their goal? As Ahmadi had patiently explained to the supreme leader of Iran, even if they failed, the cultists' actions would force the American president's hand. He would have to either make the unpopular decision to increase his military's Syrian footprint, or more likely, abandon the region altogether. Either outcome was a win. But to Ahmadi's way of thinking, an American occupation of Syria was the ultimate prize. In addition to miring the United States in yet another unwinnable war, this scenario would allow Ahmadi to build on what he'd perfected in Iraq. The wholesale slaughter of American service members. But if Husseini and his band of idiots actually succeeded, Syria would become the flashpoint for a firestorm that would engulf the entire Middle East, with Iran's greatest enemy as ground zero. Apparently, even this audacious plan hadn't been enough for Ahmadi. Rather than simply light the powder keg's fuse and hope for the best, the general wanted to guarantee a U.S. response. In this regard, Ryan, the U.S. intelligence officer, had been an answer to prayer. By handing him over to the cultists to be tortured and executed, Ahmadi was ensuring that whatever happened next, Husseini would have an American target on his back. And now Darian was standing squarely within the bullseye.
What I believe, Darian said, is that I brought the American to you. Now I believe I'll be leaving.
Of course, Husseini said, grinning. His white teeth were a startling contrast to the charcoal black of his beard. But I'd like you to witness something first.
Darian thought of the American and the crucifixion field.
Of course. Ahmadi would want to teach Darian a final lesson in the power the general could wield over those who displeased him. A way of ensuring Darian's further compliance. It wasn't enough for Husseini's cultists to video the American's brutal death. Darian's Quds Force commander Nemesis would want him to watch in person.
What do you want to show me? Darian said, thinking he already knew the answer.
He thought wrong. Chapter 59.
Carey's FN SCAR heavy rifle also sported an interceptor suppressor, but the 7.62mm round still gave a telltale crack as it broke the sound barrier. Even so, It was still a hell of a lot quieter than the sound of a fully automatic AK-47, like the one rocking and rolling less than 75 meters away. Carey was an exceptional shot, and he dropped the first three soccer players before they reached the stack of AK-47s. But he was still human. The fourth man zigged when Carey thought he was going to zag, and the round meant for the cultist's heart struck his shoulder instead. The man fell to the ground, bowling over the stacked rifles. Carey put two more into his prone form, but not before the fighter grabbed an AK and squeezed the trigger. The rifle spat half a magazine harmlessly over Carey's head, but the damage was done. Every swinging Richard in the compound now knew something was amiss. Men poured from the gated entrance like fire ants defending their mound. Carey selected his targets with analytical precision, panning his red dot from man to man, making each round count. But he might as well have been pissing into the wind. There were simply too many. This wasn't working. And then Jad gave a wet-sounding gurgle. Carey looked over to see his spotter and best friend slouch over the lip of the hide site, a rapidly expanding bullseye of red staining his shirt. Carey let his sling catch his rifle. He grabbed Jad and pulled the limp green beret into the relative safety offered by the hide site's dirt walls. Then he keyed the radio. "All Reaper elements," Carey said as he frantically ripped a pressure bandage from Jad's trauma kit. "This is Seven. Avalanche, avalanche, avalanche!" The radio came alive with excited voices, but Carey didn't reply. He was too busy trying to save his friend's life. Sergeant First Class Brian Martin didn't bother confirming his team sergeant's avalanche call. The background noise of AK-47's firing seemed confirmation enough. Instead, he stabbed a gloved finger on the Reaper 7 icon displayed on the LCD screen in front of him. Beneath his feet, the gun's hydraulic-enabled servos rotated the 120mm cannon to the required heading. Originally developed in response to the tragedy that occurred at Combat Outpost Keating, the MTAS, or Enhanced Mortar Target System, was a GPS-aligned 120mm mortar system controlled by a tactical computer. The gun was capable of servicing multiple targets in a 360-degree range fan in less than 10 seconds. In this incarnation of the formidable weapon, the gun's frame was mounted to a JLTV, or Joint Light Tactical Vehicle flatbed truck. Though the configuration looked more Mad Max than high-tech, Brian didn't care. For the first time in his Special Forces career, he had a mobile, dedicated fire support asset allocated solely to his team. And he intended to put it to use in spectacular fashion. "Avalanche," Brian said. "Fire mission. HE quick fuse. 5 rounds fire for effect. Charge 2. To either side, Brian's fellow gun crew members, Staff Sergeants Greg Glass and Jeff Mishler, were already moving. Grabbing a 35-pound mortar from the stack next to the gun, Greg hoisted the munition onto his shoulder, verifying the fuse, charge, and round type. Jeff stood next to him, the second shell in his hands, waiting. Brian confirmed the gun tube's azimuth with his own compass, double-checked the target's grid coordinates, and validated that the cannon's target line was clear of obstructions. All three actions took just seconds. "Gun up," Brian said. "Hang it." "HE," Greg said. "Charge 2, quick fuse." Brian verified a final time that the round, fusing, and charge combination that Greg had selected mirrored what he'd requested. Then the Green Beret gave the command they'd all been waiting for. "Fire!" Greg released the round into the gun's gaping maw, tracing his now empty fingers along the tube as he ducked into a crouch. Brian followed suit, hunching beneath the meager cover offered by the tactical computer as he keyed the transmit button on the radio and said, "Shot over!" A moment later, the gun belched and the mortar shell rocketed skyward. The recoil was enough to rock the 5,000-pound truck against its suspension, but the three men didn't notice. They were too busy feeding rounds into the cannon's hungry mouth. Chapter 60. "I want to show you the apocalypse," Husseini said. "Thank you for the offer," Darian said, "but I'm going to have to decline all the same." "Oh, but I insist," Husseini said. "Or more specifically, your General Ahmadi insists." As the cult leader spoke, His two bodyguards fingered the rifles strapped to their chests. The gesture's meaning wasn't difficult to discern. Darian kept his eyes on Husseini, but the whole of his attention was focused on the bodyguards. His lips formed a germane response, but his mind was calculating angles and times. Notably, the time it would take to interdict the bodyguards and the angle of the shot required to render them a non-entity. His calculations weren't reassuring. Both men wore perfectly adjusted three-point tactical slings. Either guard would easily have time to pivot his rifle to a firing position long before Darian cleared his concealed pistol. If the odds were one against one, Darian might have chanced it. But with two guards, the math didn't add up. Any way he figured it, one of the guards would get off a shot. Perhaps both. At this range, that was two shots too many. From behind the men, Katerina gave a bored yawn. To the untrained eye, she was the epitome of ease, a cat lazing in a puddle of sunlight. But to Darian, the Russian's lithe body vibrated tension. Katerina altered the equation, but not enough. The margins were still too slim. Darian had two choices. One, pull up a chair and watch as madmen brought about the end of the world. Or two, do something to shift the balance of power. He chose two. I'd be delighted to be your guest, Darian said, taking a step toward the cult leader while loosening the carbon fiber blade strapped to his forearm. Excellent, Husseini said. His surprised expression suggested that he'd expected Darian to choose differently. Launch your little birds. The cult leader directed his command to a wiry man hovering near the room's single doorway. Darian had originally dismissed him as a chief of staff or something of the like. The man had a hummingbird's mannerisms, and his slender fingers were constantly in motion. At the sound of Husseini's voice, the man's face brightened. Unclipping the handheld radio at his belt, the man matched the transmit button and issued a series of instructions. Darian couldn't follow exactly what the man said, but he knew where this was heading. He flicked his gaze toward Katerina. Then he moved toward Husseini. Imam, Darian said, drawing the room's eyes to him. Except for the pale blue pair attached to the forgotten woman lounging in the corner. The bodyguard closest to Husseini smoothly slid between Darian and the cult leader. A sound decision if this were a crowded Baghdad street and Darian a raucous protester. But this was not that. By blocking Darian's access to Husseini, the bodyguard had inadvertently stepped into his fellow protector's gun line. Much like the Israeli police officers Darian had encountered earlier, the bodyguard had completely misjudged Darian's intentions. Extending his right hand to draw the man's eye, Darian gave his left wrist a quick twist. The blade strapped against his arm slipped into his fingers. Stop, the bodyguard said, further closing the distance between them. Plastering a confused look on his face, Darian did as ordered. Inwardly, he smiled as the bodyguard moved to within knife range, placing his outstretched hand against Darian's chest. Everything was going exactly as planned. Right up until the moment the world exploded. Chapter 61. At the shot over call, Kerry stretched his body across Jad, sheltering the wounded man as best as he could. Kerry had just enough time to wish that he'd shoveled the hole a bit deeper when thunder fell from the sky.
Should have dug the hole deeper, Jad said, echoing Kerry's thoughts. His normally brown face was an appalling shade of white from blood loss, but he still managed to smile. Always the Monday morning quarterback, Kerry said, cinching down the pressure bandage on Jad's shoulder. Another round detonated, showering both men with sand and grit. The bullet wound looked like a through and through, but Kerry wasn't about to start counting his blessings just yet. Reaper 7, Reaper 12, rounds complete. Reaper 7, Roger, Kerry said, acknowledging Brian's transmission. Leading with his scar's muzzle, Kerry popped his head above the earthen berm. Hellfire and brimstone waited. Each fin-stabilized 120-millimeter round was packed with high explosives contained in a shearable metal casing.
When the shell detonated, superheated gases expanded outward at several times the speed of sound, turning the metal casing into shrapnel with a lethality radius of greater than 70 feet. The first five rounds had more than done their job. Where before the soccer field had been swarming with fighters, now only unrecognizable bits of flesh remained. The compound's main gate drunkenly hung on battered hinges 200 meters distant. The ground oozed tendrils of gray smoke, and the accompanying stench and gore was something straight out of Dante.